A quick warning, there are curse words that are unbeeped in today's episode of the show. If you prefer a beeped version, you can find that at our website, thisamericanlife.org.
Hammett's got the vibe of a guy who can handle anything. A beefy Tony Soprano type, but without the menace. We're in this big, white, four-wheel drive pickup truck that he tools around in. Me and him and a producer, Sasan Khalifi. And Hammett's task this morning requires ingenuity. His task? He's got to get to work. Step one, get himself out of Hebron, the city where he lives. This is in the West Bank, so movement on the roads is controlled by the Israeli army. And every day the army changes which exits out of the city are open.
So I checked on many groups, which entrance it's easy to go out.
These are WhatsApp and Telegram groups. Today they say that only two roads are open in and out of the city of a 250,000 people. We drive to one of them, where a handful of soldiers with assault rifles are manning a checkpoint.
They open this door around 6 at morning.
And we're third in line. There's a gate, and soldiers are going through the cars.
Yes. Also, most of the time, you will stay here between 10 minutes until 1 hour.
Today, we're lucky. We're early, the line's short, and they wave us through without stopping. After 7:30, Hammett says, they stop every car, and it gets really backed up. Hammett works for a company called Comet Me that sets up solar power and internet and water systems in Palestinian villages around the West Bank. So he spends a ton of time driving from place to place. And has had to become this kind of weird expert in 1,000 details of checkpoints and closed roads and tricks to get around. But that suits him. I'm the kind of person who likes to talk to everyone and learn everything and hear everything, he says. His truck is outfitted with video cameras in case we have any kind of run-in with Israeli settlers or the army. Hammett's had frightening moments when soldiers pulled guns on him. 45 minutes into our drive, he pulls over and points to a winding road that climbs up the side of a long, steep hill in the desert. It's easier to explain this in Arabic. So Sasan jumps in to translate.
So we can see here from up the hill, way over there, if you could see the road. This is a container crossing.
It's called the container crossing, apparently because a man used to have a little roadside stand and an old shipping container there. Now it's the notorious checkpoint that divides the north of the West Bank from the south.
See, over there, you can see the queue of cars. That means that they're just stopping every car to search the cars, and we can't see any cars moving. I would choose to go to alternative routes because we're going to get stuck there for a couple of hours.
One possible alternative route is an unpaved road that curves away in the distance that Hammett points to. But he doesn't like that option because it delivers you to another checkpoint that could be an hour and a half wait.
But I have another road. Less people, they know this road.
And do you think that's the best one to do?
Yes. And I will save a lot of time.
Okay, we just turned around, made a U-turn. Within minutes, we're off the highway and speeding down a two-lane street with houses close on either side. The danger of this route, Hammett says, is that we're going to drive by an Israeli settlement where we can get pulled over for hours. Though he has a plan for that. There are people he knows nearby that he can claim that we're visiting if we're stopped. We pop out into a clearing, then turn down an unpaved, rocky... I don't even want to call this a road. It's more like a ledge on the edge of a cliff.
Hey, could I just pause just to say, like, this is like one of the worst roads I've ever driven on. The car is rocking like left and right as if we were on a stormy sea. And even to keep the car upright, you're having to like weave back and forth.
Yeah, I can barely hold my coffee mug.
At one point in this trip, we're on a bumpy, slow road, and Hammett points to an overpass with a freeway that is just for Israelis. Cars with Israeli plates whiz by. They go through fewer checkpoints. This whole unequal road system, it's way faster for Israelis and way harder for Palestinians. It's nothing new in the West Bank. But after October 7th, after the Hamas attack, where some 1,200 Israelis were killed and another 250 taken hostage, the worst attack in Israel's history, the Israeli government struck back, not just in Gaza, where Hamas is based, where Israel's now killed over 60,000 people. They also took action in the West Bank, in all kinds of ways. Just one of them was that they installed hundreds of new checkpoints and roadblocks. From the highway, you see these yellow and orange gates that are locked shut one after another, blocking off passage to Palestinian villages, isolating them. Sometimes you see people going around the gates and running across the highway to get everyday stuff done. We pass one roadblock. It's a mound of rocks, piled 6 or 7 feet high in the middle of a street. Another is a big gate that Hamid points to and says that behind it is a community that his company Comet provides services to.
And in order for us to be able to get to our communities, we would have to drive, instead of 5 minutes to get to them from here, we would have to drive 35 minutes to 40 minutes because the gate now is closed. And has this gate been closed permanently since October 7th?
Yes.
Our trip this morning ends up taking 2.5 hours. We end up in a tiny village outside Jericho. Hamid says the checkpoints and roadblocks added over an hour to the trip.
Salaam alaikum.
His team is putting in water filtration and security cameras this particular day. And one of his coworkers was not as lucky on the roads. I'll call him Sam. All these names are made up, by the way. They all worry about retaliation from the Israelis. Sam came to work in this village today from the north, which should have taken less than an hour. But because of a checkpoint, it took six.
6 hours.
Did they search your car?
This is the point. They didn't check anything. They just want you to suffering in the road. They don't do anything, but they just want to waste your time and humiliate you, just like that. They want to let us know that they are owning these roads.
So what did you do for 6 hours?
Do some more on my laptop, sometimes watching the news, sometimes nothing, just hear a song, some songs or something.
The Israeli military categorically denies that it's using checkpoints and roadblocks to disrupt the lives of Palestinians. A spokesperson wrote to us that security forces operate, quote, under a complex security reality where terrorists embed themselves within the civilian population. Accordingly, there are dynamic checkpoints and ongoing efforts to monitor movement. He said the military tries to maintain, quote, as much as possible, the routine of everyday life of the population of the area. Sam sees it differently. He described the feeling of helplessness that he gets, waiting for hours online at a checkpoint, in this way that I didn't totally get at first, but let me share this with you. He says it feels like your hand, or some other piece of your body, has been cut off, and it's lying on the ground in front of you, and you see it there, and you can't do anything about it.
And you must say it's okay.
You must say it's okay because...
Because you can't do something about that. It's an occupation.
It's an occupation, he's saying. So much has gotten worse in the West Bank since October 7th for Palestinians. More violence, more of them driven off their land. The Israeli government has done things to choke the economy. Unemployment has soared. There's been a wave of people arrested and imprisoned with no charges and no trials. But I'm starting today's program talking about roadblocks and checkpoints. Because when I talked to people around the West Bank about what feels different since October 7th, so many people pointed to just this everyday stuff. Like the difficulty of getting from place to place has gotten harder. As Hamid put it,
you can't predict anything, so you're constantly under pressure. There's stress around you all the time.
It squeezes on your life, Hamid says. It stresses him out. When he goes to the doctor these days, his blood pressure is higher than in the past. He gets mad about little stuff. He knows he's overreacting. We're going to spend today's whole show in the West Bank, and I think I should pause now just so everybody is on the same page about what the West Bank is, okay? So if you picture Israel, it's a country roughly the size and shape of New Jersey. Gaza, where the Gaza war has been happening, is a little strip of land carved out in the west. 2 million Palestinians live there, roughly. 3 million Palestinians live in the West Bank. It is a much, much bigger chunk of land on the east side. Okay, I know, east side, West Bank. It's called the West Bank because it runs along the West Bank of the Jordan River. Israel took over the West Bank and Gaza in a war in 1967 and put them under military occupation until it figured out whether it was going to make that land part of Israel or give it to the Palestinian people in exchange for peace. If the Palestinian people were ever going to get their own state, the West Bank would probably be the heart of it. Still with me? All right, so trying to understand what was happening out in the West Bank, there's this kind of remarkable document that I learned about. It was written by the Israeli government minister, who was called the overlord of the West Bank by one Israeli publication, because basically he calls the shots there for the current government. His name is Bezalel Smotrich. And before he got this job, back in 2017, when he was a member of the Israeli parliament, he published a manifesto, whose title roughly translates to The Decisive Plan, in which he argues that as long as Palestinians continue to hope for their own homeland, the conflict between Jews and Palestinians is going to continue forever. They'll always be at war. And so he says Israel's first goal should be to destroy hope, destroy Palestinians' hopes of ever getting their own state or homeland. And he says Israel can do that by claiming more land and building more homes for Jews, by changing the facts on the ground, until, for Palestinians, quote, the point will come when frustration will cross the threshold of despair and will lead to acceptance and understanding that the cause stands no chance. It simply isn't going to happen. At that point, he says, Israel should offer them a choice. Leave and go elsewhere, or stay, a second-class resident, not full citizens. And Israel will be a Jewish state, quote, from the river to the sea. Smotrich turned down a request for an interview, but in the last 2 weeks, he made international headlines describing his current intentions for the West Bank. He was in an Israeli settlement, outdoors, at a podium, announcing that Israel was going to be building thousands of new homes in the West Bank, in a spot that would effectively split the West Bank in half. The line that made international headlines was when Smotrich said, this reality completely buries the idea of a Palestinian state. In the last few weeks, France, Britain, Australia, and Canada have announced their intention to possibly recognize a Palestinian state. And Smotrich addressed those countries directly in a speech in terms that echoed his decisive plan. He's saying anybody who tries to recognize a Palestinian state today in the world will receive our answer on the ground, not in documents, not in decisions or statements, but in facts. Facts of houses, facts of neighborhoods, roads, and more Jewish families that build lives. Today on our show, we go to the West Bank. I think the horror of what has been happening in Gaza has taken up so much of our attention that lots of us, me included, haven't really taken in the dramatic changes in the West Bank since October 7th, in settlements, in violence, in daily life, under Minister Smotrich and the current government. Israel's actions right now in the West Bank seem to have two goals: to crush the idea that a Palestinian state will ever be there, and, as Smotrich wrote in 2017, to drive Palestinians to cross the threshold of despair. When he wrote that, he was talking about building Israeli settlements, but I think he might also describe lots of things that have been happening lately. Some of the details of this really surprised me. I'm guessing they might surprise you, too. From WBEZ Chicago, it's This American Life. I'm Ira Glass. Stay with us. This is American Life, our show today about the West Bank, Act One, Ali and the Duster. So the current Israeli government took power about a year before October 7th. And from the start, it's been aggressively on the side of helping Jewish settlers build more homes and take more territory in the West Bank. Minister Smotrich talks about this proudly, how they've approved record numbers of new homes for Israelis there. All these settlements are seen as illegal under international law by most of the international community. But as part of that expansion, settlers have been pushing Palestinians off their land in the West Bank in record numbers. A group in Israel that monitors settlement expansion, Peace Now's Settlement Watch Project, says that since October 7th, settlers have pushed more than 80 Palestinian communities off their land. Before October 7th, settlers had only done that six times. And there's way more violence now against Palestinians in the West Bank by the Israeli military and Israeli settlers since October 7th. And way more Palestinians killed than in the past. Hagit Ofran, the co-director of Settlement Watch, described Israel's attitude since October 7th this way.
Everything can be justified because look what they did to us. Look how dangerous they are. But I think also the feeling of settlers now that they are in charge, They have no limits. They have their back covered by this government. They can do whatever they want. Nobody's going to hurt them. That's a big change.
One of the producers of today's show is an Israeli journalist, Yael Evan Orr. She was interested in what it's like for these Palestinian communities coming under all this increased pressure to leave. And she was calling around, talking to lots of people, until somebody said to her, you know who you should call about this? Ali Awad. Ali's 27. He lives in a tiny village called Touba, one of 19 villages in an area called Masafar Yatta, where they filmed that movie No Other Land that won the Oscar this year, and where the intimidation and harassment has been intense. Ali had been studying for his master's in English. He wanted to be a college English teacher. But instead, he's become kind of the protector of his little village. Yael talked to him over months as he had to deal with an escalating series of events that really demonstrate how things are changing in lots of parts of the West Bank. Here's Yael.
When I first talked to Ali back in November, the main thing he was doing all day was driving people around to their doctor's appointments, family gatherings, the police station. He has the only car in Touba. One car for 80 people.
I am every day available, like 24/7. All the month.
And how do you manage your calendar or schedule? Do you write it down somewhere if someone says, I need to go there on Sunday?
Yeah. I have a group in my WhatsApp called Talk to Myself, which is only myself on this group. So I check it every evening to see what tomorrow I'm up to.
Ali's car is important to Touba because the village is totally isolated. There's only one road in and out. Touba is way up on a hill, and the road is rocky. Valley's right below you. It requires a skilled driver and an SUV. But what probably makes it hardest to go in and out of Touba are the settlements. They surround Touba on three sides and cut it off from the rest of the Palestinian villages nearby. The Palestinians can't walk or drive through them, so Ali drives everyone up and down the rocky hill. He told me he's the taxi driver, the grocery delivery guy, and the ambulance driver. All combined. One of the first things you see when you get to Touba are the animals. Ali's family are shepherds. He gave me a tour. There are camels, chickens, goats, and hundreds of sheep.
It's the time for them to start getting fertilized for the first time.
How do they get fertilized, as you said?
Naturally. They
just hook up.
Yes, they just hook up. But like we have kind of a medicine, hormones, that will motivate the appetite.
I was waiting to see what words you're going to use for this.
To motivate the appetite is okay word.
It's good enough for public radio, I think, yeah.
Okay, so... Jud! Tlash attractor let tidhalo.
Ali's telling his cousin Jude, who's 9, to get off the tractor. Here's the other thing you'd see in Touba right away, besides the animals. It's Israel's flag, which feels completely out of place overlooking this Palestinian village. It's at the top of the hill, just above Ali's family's compound. Ali thinks it was placed there by settlers from the nearby outpost, Chavat Ma'on. Right after October 7th, they built a road from the outpost to the top of the hill.
And they put this flag, you see, 200 meters from here. If I get there, I will be arrested.
The flag hovers over Touba, a reminder from the settlers, day and night, we're right here. One of the first problems that cropped up after October 7th that kept Ali and his car busy was how to get kids to school. For 19 years, the kids from Touba had the Israeli military escort them as they walked to school, sometimes with an armored military vehicle. Because to get to school, they had to walk through Chavat Ma'on, the outpost, and the settlers would attack them on their way, throw rocks at them. It happened to Ali when he was a kid. I actually found some footage of him in an old Al Jazeera story. Ali was 17 at the time.
Sometimes they throw rocks, a lot of rocks, as rain falling.
After October 7th, the military refused to escort the kids anymore. The military told us that this decision was due to a lack of manpower and for security reasons. So Ali added to his list, school bus driver. He started driving the kids, as many as 14 of them. they'd all try to cram in. Sometimes it would take two trips.
What do the kids talk about in the car?
Sometimes about candies. Sometimes about homeworks.
Ali now knows a bunch of not very important secrets, he tells me. The school is actually pretty close by, about 1.5 miles. But he has to take this long way around because he can't go near the outpost. The round trip takes him a little over an hour. That's the nature of the occupation in the West Bank. It makes the Palestinians constantly work harder to get back to the thing that was normal a second ago, even though it wasn't even normal in the first place. The house Ali shares with his uncle and aunt is on a little rise. His room doesn't have much on the walls. He's not big on decorations. There are only two photos. Both of them are of his car. One is a total glam shot of the car at the car wash.
I took this picture and sent to my mom because, you know, here the car get very dusty. And she was always telling me, like, you need also to clean the car sometimes. So I sent her a photo of showing how clean the car could be.
Can I just say, the way you took this picture, I'm getting the feeling that you're very proud of this car.
Yeah, you can see. You know, like some people also like use the pronoun it for the car. I use the pronoun she for her, like, and people would say you are in a relationship with this car. So.
Ali bought her after the first car he got broke on the highway one day. Not to name names, but it was a Kia Sportage. This one is much better. A Romanian car. A Dacia Duster. An SUV. His is white. If cars had faces, I'd say this one is frowning. Ali keeps it in top shape, so it never breaks down near a settlement, and can always get out of a dangerous situation quickly. He spends nearly all of his money on it.
I don't have kids. I don't have my own kids. I don't have, like, other expenses than my cigarettes and my car, you know? You know, like, spending all your life, your energy, your money on the car is to, as a driver, to make sure that everyone in your car in the journey is safe as much as possible.
The thing is, it's not just Palestinians in the area who know the Dacia Duster. Some settlers know it too. In January, 3 months after October 7th, Ali was driving his neighbor. They were on the highway. Suddenly, another driver threw a glass bottle at them. It shattered the mirror. It was very scary. Ali thinks it might have been a nearby settler who recognized his car. The neighbor told Ali he should drive less, keep a low profile. But Ali kept on driving. The first settlers near Touba set up shop in 1981. Today, about 550 people live there. The settlement's called Ma'on. They have schools, a library, youth club. 20 years later, an outpost, Chavat Ma'on, was established nearby. It's illegal under Israeli law. And nearly 20 years after that, Chavat Ma'on sprung its own illegal outpost, called Man Farm, after the local settler leader who started it, Yisachar Man. This newer outpost is a sheep farm, and a sort of Airbnb-type setup with a campsite as well. It has 106 Google reviews with an average of 4.9 stars. Ali has known Yisachar Man since he was a kid. He remembers him harassing them on their way to school. And nowadays, he sees him around Touba, he says, at least once a week. We reached out to Yisachar Man for comment, but did not hear back. His wife told us he had no interest in speaking. Before October 7th, the settlers would mainly mess with the Palestinians when they got close to the settlements. Since October 7th, the settlers are closing in on the residents of Touba, and even entering the village. Ali told me and my producer Dana about a day last summer.
It was around 8, half past 8 in the morning or 9. My uncle was grazing like 300 sheep under his house, like where we are sitting, 200 meters under us.
This valley right below us? Just below?
The bottom of this valley just below us. Okay. And suddenly he saw like four masked settlers.
Four settlers wearing masks.
In the middle of his flock. Two started like to run towards him to scare him, and in the same time to start to take the sheep to the settlement.
How many did they get?
They took everything.
All the sheep?
All the sheep. They start to run with the sheep, and his wife and himself like were screaming at me like the settlers took all everything we have and come help us.
So Ali comes running and starts recording on his phone. Halfway up a big hill, he finds them. At the start of the video, you see two men. They're young, wearing masks. They both have large sticks in their hands. One has a rock as well. They're threatening his aunt. Ali is pleading with them in Hebrew. Stop. Stop. Put down the rock. The men yell at Ali to go home. When he starts running back, they chase him. But then, something surprising happens.
While they were attacking us, for a couple of minutes, our sheep ran back to our house. Like to the direction of our house, out of their hands, out of their control.
Ali's proud when he tells the story, because it was a rare victory. 300 sheep saved. Sheep theft has become an increasingly common phenomenon in the West Bank. A lot of times, people don't get them back, which means losing their entire livelihood. Ali says 300 sheep are worth roughly $125,000. I've seen even higher estimates. Ali doesn't really sleep at night anymore, thanks to the constant threats from settlers and his own hypervigilance. So he stays up most of the night and keeps watch over the village. He started doing this a few months before October 7th. But after, he got even more anxious. The government handed out weapons in settlements, at least 3,000 of them, in the first 2 weeks of the war. They also gave ATVs to settlers near Tuba. And a lot more settlers began walking around in military uniforms. I called Ali while he was up one night. He was in his room, sitting on his couch, getting up to go to the door every few minutes, where he had a good view of the family compound. He was drinking tea and smoking.
How many cigarettes do you usually go through?
In the night?
Yeah.
Yeah, between 7 to 10. You don't smoke, right?
I stopped. I quit.
Great.
Yes. When I was a little older than you, I quit, so you have some time. But you should quit.
Sometimes it's quiet.
I don't know.
Nothing happens. Yeah. Other nights it's not.
Just right now, while I'm talking with you, I hear outside of my room that a settler on ATV just passed through our villages.
Wow. So there are settlers there now?
Yes. Like outside of my door, there is a settler right now.
No reason for the settlers to pass through Tuba. They have much better roads on the other side of their outposts. Sometimes Ali shines a big flashlight at them as they drive by, so they know he's there keeping an eye out. After a few months of taking the kids to school, Ali found a different arrangement for them, and then spent a lot of his time driving people to the police station to file complaints after altercations with settlers. But Ali doesn't have much hope that the police will help them. In the last 2 decades, 94% of settler violence investigations ended without charges, according to human rights organization Yesh Din. Still, Ali goes to the police because he wants to have a record of everything, in case they end up in court in the future. Things got so bad in the West Bank after October 7th that in 2024, for the first time, the United States imposed sanctions on individuals and entities there. Issa Schauman, the settler leader who started the nearby shepherding outpost, caught the attention of the Biden administration. They placed sanctions on him and on his outposts. Sanctions can make it really hard to use credit cards or banks. But in January, Donald Trump took office, and the same day, he decided to call off all sanctions on West Bank settlements and individuals. We don't know if that's why, but after that, settler violence intensified in Masafer Yatta, where Tuba is. And my next call with Ali, less than a week later, was different than all the others.
Hello, hello.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me well?
I'd seen online that something big had happened in his village.
So I was sitting in the car and I was drinking tea and I was waiting for a call.
Then suddenly I saw them, six masked settlers running toward me. I saw them running from above the hill down, like, you know, like that. You feel that it's like they were like a storm. Like what I remember is like a sandstorm or whatever coming very fast towards us.
Ali gets out of his car. The parking area is in the middle of the compound. His family was all around, his uncle, his grandma, his little cousins. He started screaming, telling them to run away. He was afraid the masked men were going to hurt them. But he had another fear. The car. They're going to destroy the duster. So, after warning everyone, he went back to the car. But when he got back to the car, he saw the attackers were already there. One, he said, had an M16, and the other, a bottle of gasoline. He gave up, ran in the other direction to join his family, and started filming. In the video, the sheep are running. Someone is throwing rocks in the direction of the attackers. We see smoke, flames, things break. Ali realizes his little cousins, Julie and Jude, ages 7 and 9, are still in the house, next to the fire. He yells at them to come out. He yells at his family and neighbors to get away from the attackers. The attackers, apparently done with what they wanted to do, run off. Just 5 minutes have passed. Ali goes back to the parking area, and we finally see the car in the video. Huge flames fill the interior and pour out of all the windows. Ali and I talked on Zoom 2 days after that happened.
I mean, luckily, I'm still alive, not being burned inside the car, so that's still a huge miracle and something to be thankful about.
How are your cousins doing now after this attack?
Still very traumatized.
Ali said that the attackers went into the house where the kids were. They didn't have time to escape. The attackers hit Julie with a rock on her back and Jude with a stick on his elbow.
Either they are not sharing, but I was, when I was in their age, I was not saying anything to anyone, but I remember how much I am scared. You know, like when I was 6, I used to go to school, entering inside Khafat Ma'on and facing the most brutal attacks on my way to school. And I wanted to convince my parents not to go to school.
Yeah.
Because of how much I was scared. So, for sure, this is what the children are feeling.
Why didn't you say anything when you were a kid?
I don't know, like, yeah. You know, what would be like the results of sharing? That's what I remember, that even if I share, there is nobody that is actually able to end this like reality.
The second photo in Ali's room, it's the image of the car burning. The top part of the car is all fire. The bottom is charred. Smoke billows off to the very blue sky. The car was so important to Ali, to Tuba, that I was sure he would already have a plan to replace it. But he was paralyzed.
The ability of getting another vehicle is not the most difficult part. The most difficult part is what will be the fate of a new car.
Yeah.
This is the most devastating part. This is like the part that, like saying to me, don't get another car. Because if they burn this one, they might burn the other one. So if they can do that at 2 p.m., like not at midnight or not at 2 a.m., if they can do it at 2 p.m., then this is a very scary situation.
The police came to Touba the same day to investigate. They sent a specialist to try to collect evidence. They took some rocks, looked for fingerprints in the car. But Ali says they didn't find anything. Two teenagers from Chavat Maon were arrested, but they were released less than a week later. Ali heard the case had been closed. So many cars have been set on fire in recent years in the West Bank that a big Palestinian insurance company has started to offer settler attack insurance. They put out an ad with a picture of a car burning intensely. After the Zoom call, I didn't hear from Ali. For weeks. He stopped answering my texts. He was silent on social media. Finally, he resurfaced. "Sorry for my silence," he texted. "I hope you're all right." Turned out, a few days after our call, he had been arrested. He was released the same day, never charged, but the police kept his phone. I reached out to the police about this and about the car attack and never heard back. Ali felt like so much had been taken away from him. His car, his documents, which he kept in his car, his phone.
Everything was gone in just 5 days. Like, everything.
He got depressed and did something that no one here remembers him doing before. He took off, left Touba for about a week, and went to stay with a friend. His aunt, Aisha, told us that he never leaves. He's always there, ready to protect them. But Ali was the most scared he's ever been. He needed a beat to be alone, to recover. Life in Touba was always a struggle, with the settlers around. But Ali says that since October 7th, it feels like they're pushing towards a specific goal.
They are working to kick the Palestinians out of their homes. This is what their message is, like, leave from here. The government, the Israeli occupation government, is preventing us from building houses, from building schools, from building any kind of medical or educational units, building roads. They are preventing us from surviving, and we survive with whatever we can. The settlers would say, if this is not enough to make you leave this land, we will do it with shooting, with, like, making your life hell.
And what's your message back?
Are you trying to push me out of here? I didn't even decide to fuck live here. I wouldn't even choose to come to Masafer Yatta between, I don't know, Valdagno or Vicenza or Padova.
These are names of Italian towns. Ali loves Italy, but he's from Touba. His family has lived there for generations.
It's my home. I was born here. Are you blaming me for something I ended up in?
In June, settlers injured more Palestinians in the West Bank than they have in any other month over the past two decades, according to the UN. About a month ago, a friend of Ali's was shot and killed by a settler in a neighboring village. Ali's friend was filming a clash between the settler and some Palestinian residents, so it's all on video. The shooter claimed self-defense. He was arrested, but was released after a few days. At least 11 Palestinians were also arrested, including Ali, who wasn't even there. Back when I visited Ali, in April, he told me he'd made a decision about the car. He was going to fix the duster, which seemed impossible to me. But then, in June, I called him.
Hello.
Hi, Ali.
Hi, Ayel.
How are you?
I'm good. Now the car is fixed and it's already packed back in Touba, parked here.
Wow. He sent a photo. The Dacia Duster was back.
Yael Evan Orr. Coming up, an Israeli doctor tries to make sense of a case that does not make sense. That's in a minute. From Chicago Public Radio, when our program continues. It's Just American Life. I'm Ira Glass. Today's show, The Other Territory. We're looking at what's been happening in the West Bank while the world's attention has been on Gaza. And before we turn to Act Two, there are two quick snapshots that I want to share with you of life in the West Bank since October 7th. Here's the first. It's a hall in a municipal park, a place where normally you would have a wedding or some other celebration, where 16 families are living. Mats on the floor where they sleep.
This room that you see here, this single room, 40 people sleep in it. There are no secrets. We change in front of each other. We sleep facing each other. There are no beds.
That's Nawal Mohammed Mahmoud Haykal, 31, a single mother with two daughters. She spoke with journalist Ahmed Al-Baaz. Nawal is here because of something new that the Israeli army started doing in the West Bank in January. The country's defense minister announced that month that the military was going to start using the tactics that they've been using in Gaza to level houses and neighborhoods. But now they were going to do that in the West Bank. And so Operation Iron Wall attacked four Palestinian refugee camps that are basically cities, with tanks and airstrikes and bulldozers tearing up the roads and knocking down buildings, displacing at least 30,000 people, according to the United Nations. It's unclear when or if they'll ever be able to move back. When Nawal talked to Ahmed, the Israeli military just published a map indicating what houses they were going to demolish next.
Yeah, I saw it. That's my parents' home. They're threatening my parents' home with demolition. Yes, they have a circle around it. On my parents' home, they have two dots on it. They're threatening demolition. I live in my parents' home in a room. For us, the camp is our entire life.
Okay, here's a second snapshot. This one, a bright, shiny car dealership, chock-a-block with shiny new cars.
So I'm looking around the showroom, two-floor showroom, and I don't see any customers.
We have one, only.
Wait, who's the customer?
Downstairs, that man. Abu Sleiman. He's the customer, yes.
Abdullah Al-Nacha is the showroom manager for Al-Salam Motors in the city of Hebron. This is a family business with a car lot, car repair, gas station, and, curveball here, French fry factory. And this is something I didn't really understand before I visited the West Bank, is just what a disaster its economy is right now. For a bunch of reasons. But one of the big ones is that roughly 120,000 Palestinians used to commute from the West Bank into Israel. And after October 7th, the Israeli government forbade most of them from doing that, saying it was for security reasons, even though Israel's own security services, Shin Bet, said the risk could be managed. Shin Bet, in fact, said it would be riskier to leave so many people unemployed and discontent. But those tens of thousands of commuters were not just the backbone of the Palestinian economy. They were Abdullah's customers.
They buy cars, new cars, or they buy lands, or they buy many things. And since the 7th of October, they all unemployed.
People can't make their car payments, and the dealership's been repossessing vehicles. They've gone from selling 560 cars a year to 175. They've let a third of their employees go in all their businesses. This bit also surprised me. Post October 7th, they say Israeli companies decided to stop selling them potatoes for the French fry factory. Abdullah also says that the local Palestinian government in the West Bank, Palestinian Authority, owes them $6 million for construction and agricultural equipment that it bought.
How soon do you think you'll get paid?
They send like each month around $20,000 each month. Yes.
Well, that just barely covers the interest.
Doesn't cover the interest.
Why can't they pay?
They can't pay because they don't have money.
Palestinian Authority doesn't have money, in part because the Israeli government has withheld hundreds of millions of dollars in tax revenues from it. A World Bank report in June described its finances as a fiscal crisis. But because they are the only local buyers for this kind of gear, Abdullah continues to sell to them.
They still buy equipment now, yes.
And so how much does that thing cost?
Each equipment around $140,000.
And how much do they put down? How much do they pay when they buy? 30%?
No, nothing. Zero.
What?
Zero.
How do I get that deal?
You have to be Palestinian Authority or one of them. Yes.
This is the kind of family business where once a week they play volleyball together. It's brothers and cousins and Abdullah's uncle managing this business. And when I asked Abdullah's cousin, Wajdi, how this has affected him personally, how hard it's been keeping the business going, he said that for the first time in his life, he's thought about moving away for a little bit.
Until this war finished, to go abroad.
Have you told your brother you've had these thoughts?
Yes.
What's he say?
Shut up. Think about your business here and my family as well.
Every person I talk to in the West Bank seems stressed out about money. People with jobs are supporting people who lost jobs. Meanwhile, prices for food and gas are rising. The only business I ran across that seemed to be doing okay is this guy, Bilal. He sells this incredible corn that is covered in brightly colored powders and sauces, including this TikTok-ready fluorescent teal sauce from a stand on the street. He's saying that ever since October 7th, people are just sitting around without work, not doing anything. And they wander around the streets, and corn, they can afford. His business has improved. Act two, what happened to Waleed? Since October 7th, there have been a ton of arrests in the West Bank, doubling the number of Palestinians in Israeli prisons. Now it's over 10,000 people, according to the Israeli government. They're held as security prisoners, not on normal criminal charges. Most are from the West Bank. Over 3,600 are in something called administrative detention, where they're not charged with anything and there's no trial. They're just held based on classified evidence they don't see and can't contest. Israeli prisons were notoriously overcrowded, even before October 7th. But in general, not many Palestinians died in Israeli prisons. In the year before October 7th, it was two Palestinians, according to Physicians for Human Rights, Israel. Since October 7th, they count at least 93 Palestinians who died in Israeli custody. Naji Abbas works for Physicians for Human Rights and says after October 7th,
it started to be weird because every week, every 2 weeks, you are getting a call saying there is a new death.
So what is happening in these prisons? Well, in the wake of the Hamas attack on Israel, Israel's Minister of National Security, a far-right politician named Itamar Ben-Gvir, enacted some changes to the prison system. Ben-Gvir is a longtime provocateur and ultranationalist, somebody who's been convicted of supporting a Jewish terrorist organization and incitement to racism. After the Hamas attacks, Ben-Gvir drastically limited security prisoners' contact with the outside world. Didn't matter whether they were accused of any connection to the Hamas attacks or Hamas itself. Families can't visit anymore. They can't call. The Red Cross, which had monitored conditions inside Israeli prisons since 1967, is now barred. In public statements, Ben-Gvir refers to all Palestinian security prisoners as terrorists. The physical conditions inside prisons have gotten a lot worse, too. Scabies infestations are rampant and have been for over a year. I didn't know this. Scabies is a contagious skin disease caused by mites. Prisoners tell their lawyers that a dozen people are sometimes crammed into a cell meant for five or six. And Ben-Gvir reduced prisoners' food rations to the minimum allowable by Israeli law. Closed the canteens where prisoners could buy their own food. Ben-Gvir didn't try to hide any of this. Last July, he posted on X, quote, "Since I assumed the position of Minister of National Security, one of the highest goals I have set for myself is to worsen the conditions of the terrorists in the prisons and to reduce their rights to the minimum required by law." He told the Associated Press that the purpose of these changes was to deter terrorism. Again, here's Naji Abbas of Physicians for Human Rights.
By the Israeli law, the punishment for an offense or a crime or when you are charged with something, the punishment is limiting your freedom, taking your freedom of movement. That is the punishment. But Ben-Gvir, he was very clear from the day one in the office that he think that the conditions of the detention, not the detention itself, the conditions of the detention should be part of the punishment.
Palestinian prisoners began dying, many of them not very old, in their 40s, 30s, 20s. We don't know what happened to most of them. There have been a few autopsies that Physicians for Human Rights knows about, but even the families of the prisoners who get autopsies almost never get an autopsy report. Here's what they get instead. They're allowed to send a doctor to observe the postmortem examination on their behalf. This doctor doesn't actually participate in the autopsy. They just watch the procedure, and then afterwards write up an account, just a page or two, about what they saw. And since October 7th, their observations, these written reports, have become one of the only windows into what is happening to security prisoners inside Israeli prisons today. Dan Chivas has the story of one of those accounts.
The place where these autopsies are performed is called Abu Kabir. It's in Tel Aviv. It's the Israeli government's forensic medicine institute. Since October 7th, courts have dictated that only Israeli doctors can attend autopsies on behalf of the families. So Physicians for Human Rights went in search of Israeli doctors who'd be willing to go on behalf of Palestinian families. One of the people they called was Dr. Daniel Solomon, an Israeli physician born in Italy. He's on the board of Physicians for Human Rights, volunteers with their mobile medical clinic in the West Bank. Do-gooder kind of guy. Daniel had never been to an autopsy before. He's a surgeon, not a forensic pathologist. Those are the doctors specially trained to do autopsies. But Daniel said sure, he'd go. He didn't have much time to prepare.
I looked a bit online on how an autopsy is performed and how maybe a report can look like. And that was it.
Daniel had also never been inside Abu Kabir, the forensic institute, though he'd jogged by it a bunch. The first time Daniel went, it was only 3 weeks after the Hamas attacks on October 7th. The staff at Abu Kabir was still processing the remains of Israelis who had been killed. In a different room, down the hall, Daniel observed the autopsies of two Palestinian prisoners that day. Over the course of the next year, he went to 5 of these autopsies. All Palestinian men from the West Bank who had died in Israeli prisons. After each one, Daniel wrote up his observations. One had, quote, multiple signs of physical assault and injury. Another had a relatively recent head trauma. Daniel saw conditions he assessed as treatable. One man's lungs were in the worst shape Daniel had ever seen. One of the lungs was surrounded by pus and completely collapsed. He was 23. Daniel's view was that based on the condition of the lungs, the man would have been coughing violently and noticeably for at least a week. Daniel's used to seeing bodies inside and out. He's a surgeon. Standing there observing during the autopsies, taking notes, he kept a practiced, emotional distance from the body, same as he does when he's in surgery. And then, this March, there was Waleed Ahmed, 17 years old. Daniel had read about Waleed's death in the news. It made international headlines. The first Palestinian teenager to die inside an Israeli prison since Israel took over the West Bank in 1967, according to Physicians for Human Rights. Waleed was from the West Bank, a town called Seel Wad. Palestinian officials told reporters he had fallen and hit his head, citing other prisoners' accounts. When Daniel got to Abu Kabir for Waleed's autopsy, the staff there did something they'd never done on any of his previous visits. They warned him about what he was about to see.
They were telling me, like, they were commenting before he came in to kind of, like, get ready. He doesn't look good. The moment they placed his body on the autopsy table, I understood that I was dealing with something and that I was not actually prepared to witness. The way he looked, it's hard to describe. It was difficult for me to even call it malnutrition. This is how starvation looks like. I think the only thing that comes close to that, in my opinion, is really those pictures of the Holocaust. That's how bad it was. Then I deal with cancer patients. I've seen anorexia. I've seen people get as thin as it gets. I honestly have never seen someone looking like he did.
This interview was several months ago, before photos of starvation in Gaza were widespread. In the news stories about Waleed, there was a photo of him from right before he was arrested. Waleed looks like a strapping teenage boy. Dirty blonde hair, the beginnings of a beard. He's fit, a soccer star, hoping to join the Palestinian national team. Nothing at all like the body Daniel was seeing on the metal table in front of him.
It's just like two absolutely different persons. I mean, it was really beyond recognition.
Again, Daniel's account is not an official autopsy report. He doesn't have access to additional information. For instance, tests done on Waleed's body after the autopsy. He doesn't know for sure how Waleed got to look the way he did at the end. But his assessment is that however it happened,
starvation at the end of the day killed him because he exposed him so much to other diseases that might have been treatable and that in his case just become fatal.
Daniel addressed his account of the autopsy, quote, to the family of Waleed Ahmed. Waleed was a case where, in Daniel's view, everything he was seeing could have been treated. His significant weight loss, also scabies. Daniel's account also said Waleed had an inflammation of the colon. He did not see any evidence of a head injury, external or internal. Waleed's body had been sent to Abu Kabir with notes from the prison medical clinic. Daniel read them and wrote in his account that in December, Waleed had gone to the prison medical clinic and, quote, mentioned that he did not have access to sufficient amounts of food. Daniel said that, according to the prison notes, Waleed had said other prisoners were taking his food. The month before Waleed died, he went to the clinic two more times. Israeli law says that, quote, a prisoner shall be entitled to the medical care necessary to maintain his health and to appropriate monitoring conditions as stipulated by an IPS physician. IPS is Israel Prison Service.
The relevant thing is that he was someone who was under the responsibility of the Israeli Prison Service. He was under a system that failed him so badly.
The Israel Prison Service told me it doesn't comment on individual cases, but they sent a statement saying, in part, quote, all inmates are held according to legal procedures and their basic rights, including access to medical care, are upheld by professionally trained staff, subject to internal and external review. It took Daniel a couple of days to write his account.
Just because I wanted it to be accurate, and sometimes it's really not that easy to find the wording, like somewhere in between something that a physician can understand, but something that also the family can understand.
Daniel's account, with his observations, went to Waleed's father, Khalid. Until he got it, he didn't know anything about how his son died or why. He says he just got a call one night, close to midnight, telling him Waleed was dead. Khalid is the only one in the family who read all of Daniel's report. He said Waleed's mother, siblings, and aunts couldn't bear to finish it.
Before receiving the report, knowing that Waleed was in good health, my first thought was it was a result of torture or beating. I sought help from a doctor here in town, and he explained to me the entire report, like for medical terms. He explained all the details and all the different small parts in it. That was, it just made it more shocking. I mean, my son, Waleed, was an athletic young man. I don't know what they did to him in prison.
Waleed, Khalid said, had cared how he looked, showered twice a day. In photos, he's always dressed nicely, usually in name brands, Hilfiger, Polo.
Waleed liked things that were for clothes. He liked the nicest things. He wanted the nicest, best things. He did not used to ask, of course, but I knew what he liked. When we would go out to buy clothes, I knew his taste. He liked everything to be neat.
Waleed was planning to go to university next year to study finance and banking, Khalid told me. Some nights after school and over the summer break, he worked at Khalid's shop. Khalid's mother was Brazilian. He imports nuts and coffee from Brazil and elsewhere. Waleed was a senior in high school. From what I can see, his social media is filled with photos of him and his friends, often preening, often in front of cars, mixed in with memorial posts for young men who have died and support for others who are in prison. In a couple photos, people are holding guns. From the outside, it's hard to tell what any of that adds up to. But I showed all this to a Palestinian journalist who said he's seen hundreds of accounts like this. Waleed had never been arrested before, his lawyers say. The military came in the middle of the night, last September, 2024. Middle of the night raids are the standard way the military arrests Palestinians in the West Bank, including minors. That was true even before October 7th. But there have been so many more arrests since then. Khalid says everyone was asleep when they came. Him and his wife, all four kids. At 17, Waleed was the oldest. Khalid estimates there were 25 soldiers. He says some of them broke two doors, came into the house, and smashed the windows of the front room, flipped over couches, tore curtains.
As soon as they entered, they started saying to me, "You're Hamas, you're Hezbollah." I told them, "I'm neither Hamas nor Hezbollah." They went into the kids' room and terrified them. I told the soldiers, "Wait, wait, let me." So then I went and gathered all the children and put them here in the spot.
Khalid says Waleed had on only his underwear and a tank top when they took him away.
When they were arresting Waleed, I said to the officer, "Let us just put pants on him," because that night it was a bit cold. I said, "Let us put pants and a jacket on him." But the officer refused.
When I asked the Israeli military about Khalid's account of the arrest, they told me that no one filed a report complaining about how it was handled. 2 weeks after Waleed was arrested, 5 months before his death, he was charged with producing an explosive or incendiary device, which is identified as a Molotov cocktail, throwing an explosive device, and arson. The charging document is remarkably vague. There are no specific locations saying where the crimes allegedly happened, or specific times. One incident supposedly took place, quote, sometime during the year 2022. One of Waleed's lawyers pointed out that there's no complainant listed on the charging document. Nobody who went to the authorities and said, "This kid threw a Molotov cocktail at my house and caused damage to me." If there were, he said, there would have been more specificity to the charges. The evidence against him seemed to be allegations from two other prisoners. Waleed was being tried under Israeli military law, where the standards of evidence are lower than in civilian court. All Palestinians in the West Bank are subject to military law. That's been true for almost 60 years. In response to my questions about Waleed's case, the Israeli military sent a statement that said, in part, that Waleed was, quote, imprisoned based on well-founded evidence of his offenses, including testimonies from other operatives against him. It's not clear if Waleed did any of the things he was charged with. His lawyer said he denied it, and Waleed died before he could give his defense or take a plea. Khalid spent 6 months trying to find out what was happening to his son in prison. He learned pretty quickly that Waleed was in Megiddo prison, hours away, outside the West Bank, in Israel. No one in the family was allowed to communicate with him. They couldn't visit him. Throughout last fall and winter, Khalid went to Waleed's court hearings in a military courtroom in the West Bank. The prosecutors and judges were all in the Israeli military. Waleed appeared remotely over a video connection from prison. Khalid saw Waleed for the last time like this, on a TV screen during a court hearing in February. Could you tell how he looked physically?
I saw his face. Of course, we could only see him from here and up. His face was thinner. But the day I saw him, he smiled to my face and I smiled back.
Khalid says he saw him for only about 20 seconds. Waleed died 6 weeks later, on March 22nd. The family was informed 2 days after. What Physicians for Human Rights and others were learning around the time Waleed died sheds light on how Waleed might have become so frail in the weeks between when his father last saw him on screen and his death. They learned that some sort of gastrointestinal illness was going around the prison. Lawyers for Palestinians in Israeli prisons reported seeing their clients deteriorate from one visit to the next, getting very thin. Prisoners, including minors, told told their lawyers they were vomiting, had diarrhea, were sometimes fainting, and were rapidly losing weight. Khalid, Walid's father, had heard about it from a friend of Walid's, who'd been in the same prison and was released. We heard about it from another teenager who was also held at Megiddo prison at the same time as Walid and knew Walid. He's 16 years old, and he first spoke to reporter Hagar Shezaf at the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. In the Haaretz story, he's called Ibrahim. It's not his real name. I'm going to use that name for him, too. Ibrahim's experience in prison mirrored Walid's in several important ways, and he was an eyewitness to Walid's last days. He talked to my producer in the West Bank. Ibrahim and Walid were arrested around the same time. He said Walid joked around a lot. He was a talker.
Yes, I talked to him a lot. Almost every day I talked to him. When he used to live with me in the same cell, I used to talk to him. We used to talk about food because we were starving. He would say to me, when we get out, God willing, but we will go to my father's store, we will eat cashews and nuts.
Ibrahim said they never got enough food. He said everyone was hungry, and everyone stole food from each other. After the first 2 months, they weren't in the same cell anymore. And then around the beginning of March, Ibrahim got sick. He was dropping weight, vomiting, diarrhea. He said when he saw Walid, he noticed Walid had similar symptoms. Ibrahim was so sick, he said, he couldn't make it to the toilet in time. He said his sheets were filthy. He couldn't wash his clothes. He smelled. It made him feel like a little child. Ibrahim told Haaretz that when he asked for medical help, he was given an over-the-counter drug similar to Tylenol and was told to eat rice and drink water. He said 5 of his 9 cellmates had the same symptoms. Ibrahim said Walid deteriorated visibly. He said he saw Walid the morning he died.
Okay, so we were out for the break. Everybody ran towards the bathrooms. His body was weak. I mean, he couldn't walk a lot. He couldn't run. Neither could I. He opened the cell door. We came out towards the bathrooms. Suddenly, he fell on the floor and started bleeding from his mouth. They told us to go back to the cells. We thought it was going to be a crackdown and beating. But when we went back into the cells, Walid was bleeding out of his mouth. They put him on the gurney and took him.
After Walid died, Ibrahim said the prison made a few changes. They separated out the thinnest prisoners and gave them more food, brought in a washing machine. In May, 6 weeks after Walid died, Ibrahim was released from prison 11 days early. Ibrahim says he weighed 159 pounds when he entered prison. When he left, he was only 101 pounds, according to the parole board. The parole board noted he was, quote, difficult to look at and a cause of great concern.
This is for Walid. And this is for Walid.
When I visited Khalid in April at the family's home, it's pretty, stone, lots of tall windows. He showed me Walid's trophies and ribbons on a display shelf in their sitting room. They were for soccer. Walid was a goalie, and also for kickboxing.
This also was for Walid.
And also a competition known as the Math Olympics.
I put him in private school since he was bright and driven. He was well known for his intelligence and his excellence in math.
The kid in Khalid's head was Walid suspended in amber. Walid from before he was arrested. This energetic teenager barreling towards adulthood. He had big ideas for the family business. He wanted to expand, open more stores, learn different roasting and grinding methods, get into cappuccino and espresso. He wanted the company to be a brand name. Khalid had been planning to take Walid on a trip to Brazil this summer. Walid had never been. He had just signed Walid up for driving lessons when he was arrested. They were a close family.
في عندنا احنا داخل البيت هنا طاولة شوية.
We have a table here in the house in the middle and we would spend so much time chasing each other around the table. I would come from here, he would go from there. I would go from there, he would come from here.
عشان لياقته عالية.
I would climb the table to get to him, but because he was in good shape, he would get away. His mom would feel bad for him and tell me, poor him, you keep chasing after him. I tell her, he is the one chasing me.
The reason Khaled agreed to an autopsy in the first place is that his lawyer told him it could help him get Waleed's body back. It's the practice of the Israeli government to hold onto bodies of Palestinian prisoners, to keep them as bargaining chips. Hamas does it too, with Israeli bodies. Since October 7th, Israel hasn't released the bodies of any Palestinian prisoners, including Waleed's. So Khaled is still waiting. He still hasn't buried his son.
Dana Chivas. Our program is produced today by Dana Chivas and Yael Evan-Orr, edited by Nancy Updike, David Kestenbaum, and myself. The people who put together today's show include Jindai Bonds, Michael Comite, Suzanne Gaber, Han Javi Wall, Catherine Raimondo, Valerie Kipnis, Andrea Marks, Joe Nelson, Nadia Raymond, Ryan Rummery, Ike Sriskandaraja, Lily Sullivan, Francis Swanson, Chris Rosatala, Julie Whitaker, and Diane Wu. Our managing editor is Sara Abdurrahman. Our executive editor is Emmanuel Berry. Other people who worked on the show as reporters and producers, Ahmed Albaz, Jude Taha, Salsan Khalife, and Hani Hawasli, editor Sara Yassin, translators Shani Aviram, Talia Krevsky, Bashar Ahalabi, and Dana Balut, also voice actor Waleed Zuater. Special thanks today to Henriette Shakar, Noah Cohen, Matt Duss, Oriel Eisner, Daniel Estrin, Kara Lee Francis, Netta Freha, Olit Gavati, Rami Ghali, Umel Gatatvi, Harlow Holmes, Matthew Hooper, the team at Hotspot Cover, Aida Kaden, Ariel Kahana, Jessica Montel and Danny Shenhar at Hamoked, Riham Nasra, Raviv Rose, Noah Satat, Gabriel Shander, Stefan Schmidt, Guy Shalev, Ofer Shelach, Yura Shaul, Hagar Shazaf, and Seth Fried Wessler. Our website, thisamericanlife.org. This American Life is delivered to public radio stations by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Thanks, as always, to our program's co-founder, Mr. Tori Malatia, who's like, yeah, yeah, Robert Frost, two roads diverge in a yellow wood.
But I have another road.
I'm Eric Glass. Back next week with more stories of This American Life.